Six music.
BBC Radio, Six Music Documentaries.
I'm Matt Everett, and this is the first time where we speak to some of the most influential figures in music about the pivotal first moments that shaped their lives and careers, the events and songs that led them to be where and who they are today. And today's guest is unusually not a musician, but he's made an incredible impact on music in the UK. As the man behind Creation Records, from 1983 till 1999, Alan McGee has been a guiding force in the careers of the Jesus and Mary Chain, Ride, My Bloody Valentine, Teenage Fan Club, Super Furry Animals, and most famously, Oasis. But back to Alan McGee and the first time. And we start by asking the nascent record label boss when he first became aware of music.
The first time that I became aware of music, I was about 11 and I bought Get It On. And there was, I think, what was the record shop? It was in Battlefield. I can't remember what the name of the record shop was, but I bought Get It On. And that was my first. I mean, it sounds like an incredibly hip record to say that you bought, but I did buy Get It On as my first pop single.
The high
So were you instantly enamoured of music?
I probably, it was really subliminal, really, because I had no idea that... I was really, to be honest, I was really, really into T-Rex, and then I was into Slade, and then I was really into Bowie, and then...
What era Bowie?
It was Ziggy, and then I went back to Hunky Dory, and then I got into Aladdin Sane, and then I got into Diamond Dogs, and it was like... And it was really like that, and I kind of got into Dylan when I was about 15, and then punk happened.
Did that have a big impact?
Well, that punk sort of changed my life, really. I'd stopped going to school at 14 because I'm a dad and I've got a 10-year-old kid. It's kind of weird because it's like, you know, you have to make these decisions now about education and stuff for your kid. And I kind of stopped going to school about 14 because it was just through survival, really. It was like, you didn't learn at my school. I don't think you did anyway.
This
was in Glasgow. I didn't even go to a particularly really, really bad one. It was just like a normal Glasgow school. But really, it was more about not getting your head kicked in. And then I think in the first year of me being at school, I probably saw somebody get smashed over the face with a police baton. And then I saw a couple of people get punctured by various implements, which was kind of a bit shocking to an 11-year-old guy. But by the time I was 14, I realised that the way not to get stabbed was not to go.
Escapism for you then, because you chose Bowie, very glamorous, T-Rex, very glamorous, very different to, I presume, growing up in Glasgow at the time.
Music probably was escapist. Punk hadn't happened at that point, and Bowie, it was like, I suppose there was a lot of stuff going on, really. It was like, because when Bowie came along, I didn't know if I wanted to be Bowie or I fancied Bowie. Probably wanted to be him, but equally fancied him at the same time. And I'm actually, as far as I understand, I'm heterosexual, but as if that matters. But it's like, but that's what Bowie was like an alien. Do you know what I mean? That was the genius of Bowie. Nobody now. I mean, I know the kids probably. If you were 10 or something or 11, well, maybe Lady Gaga's an alien, but really, to be honest, Bowie, you've got to understand the stuff that Bowie was throwing up when I was 11 and 71 was in 72. It was like, nobody was like wearing makeup and kind of had that haircut that Sid Vicious went on to copy. It was throwing up such sexual issues and like, it was almost like androgyny or pandrogyny, possibly, that, you know, a man morphing into a woman, you know?
What about the first concert you went to? Can you remember?
My first...
Gig.
Oh, right, okay. I think it was Queen in 75, and that's pretty good. And I used to go to see Lynyrd Skynyrd and Thin Lizzy and stuff like that, you know, that... And, you know, Bowie and... Slade, just stuff like that. It was all going on at the time, really, and I loved all that. And I never saw Roxy for some reason. I don't know why I never saw Roxy, but they were all amazing. Queen were amazing, to be honest. Queen, even to this day, I think Queen are pretty amazing, to be honest.
What about your first band and your first kind of forays into kind of?
Oh, you mean the first band that I was that I thought I was a musician, right?
Yeah, first band you were in.
All right, okay, but that was me and Andrew Innes and Bobby Gillespie, and we were called Captain Scarlet and the Mistrons. We never did a gig. Thank God. We were actually probably okay because Gillespie could probably sing just about at that point, and then I could probably blag the bass at that point. But Andrew Innes was one of these guys, because you were in a band yourself, obviously, as we talked earlier on. We met Andrew, me and Bobby, when he was 15, and he could play. Do you know what I mean? He couldn't just play like Hate and War of the Clash or Complete Control of the Clash. He could play Freebird, Lynyrd Skynyrd. He was one of these weird guys. He was 15 and he could play everything. See, he was just... I think Bernard Butler's one of these guys as well. I had a discussion with Bernard Butler about 15 years ago. And we were talking... I think some people just... It's like picking up a guitar is like picking up a glass of water. It's just like... you know, you can just do that. Yeah, Andrew Innes was one of these guys. He could just do it. And so he probably made us sound quite good. If we ever had played a gig, we could have probably blagged it, you know. Because Gillespie just used to... He didn't even know who Iggy Pop was in 77, 78. But he used to roll... I think he thought he was Jimmy Pursley. And he used to roll about the ground. But he was actually being Iggy Pop. And then I probably, in my head, thought I was like... I don't know. Yeah, I thought it was Glenn Matlock or something.
What covers did you do?
I think we used to do Clash songs. And actually, we used to do Borstal Breakout. I actually remember that.
You moved down to London.
Yeah.
And part of another band, but also set up your
first. I came down as part of this band, Newspeak.
Right.
And then the singer left because he couldn't hack London, and it was left me and Ed. Well, that's which is fair enough. I mean, some people like it, some people don't. Me and Ed loved it, and Jack, who came down with us, his name was Jack Riley, and he's a nice guy, actually. He was probably too nice for me and Andrew, who were like... A couple of little, you know, how could you put it, obnoxious people. So it was, me and Andrew started this band, The Laughing Apple, and because we couldn't even get a gig, we started doing these 7-inch singles, and Sounds decided that me and Andrew were the next big thing for about 2 weeks, and Dave McCulloch did 3 pages on us in Sounds, and we were like, We thought we were pop stars for about 5 minutes. So it's kind of funny. And then we put out a couple of singles and we got quite good reviews. John Peel kind of liked us. And then the band kind of broke up and I tried to kind of like not be involved with music anymore because I've never really told this story publicly before. We did this gig with Alison Gaza as Laughing Apple at Edinburgh University. And after we came off stage, it was like a 2,000 capacity hall and we managed to pull about 250 people. But anyway, we went in, we were just kids, we were like 21-year-old kids, and we went into this room. And this was kind of how Creation Records started. There was all these drums, and Adam and the Ants was really big in 1981, 1982. And about 11 of us... Me and Alison Gaza and Dick Green, and who, you know, is still kicking about doing Wichita Records and everything, who owned Done Creation with me, we were all playing these Burundi drums. So I don't know what we invoked, but at the end of the day, we ended up And this is no word of a lie, but I had this £400 bass guitar that was my prized possession. The guy taking it out of this Edinburgh venue got punched in the throat and my guitar got nicked. So I was gutted and I was like in the back of the van and I was like, oh, really, really. And Dick was driving it and then we hit black ice and the van turned over 3 or 4 times and it was pretty horrific, really, you know, look, but unbelievable. We wrote the van off. Nobody got killed. But because I'd lost my bass and then smashed the van up, as in, like, wrote it off, it wasn't even our van, it was a hired van, we broke the band up and I tried to go into a straight life, like, with no music, which I tried to do for about 6, 7, 8, 9 months, and then I couldn't do it. I wanted something to do with music. So I started this club called The Living Room. And then I suppose the rest is history, because through that, we suddenly became instantly successful, because it was in 1983, Matt, there was nothing like what we were doing, which was these small indie gigs. And now I'm sure it happens the whole time. Well, it does happen the whole time. But nobody was putting on the Nightingales and the TV Personalities and ATV and the Three Johns, and nobody was doing that, and the Pastels. So we put on all these bands and we were instantly successful. And after about 3 months of making a lot of money out of it, because we were making about £500-600 a week out of doing the club, because we used to do it for 2 nights, we started making records. And that was the start of Creation Records, really. And then through the club, we found lots of bands. We found The Loft. We found the Jesus and Mary Chain. Primal Scream played their first ever show. When it was just Bobby and Jim Beatty in a drum machine. And it kind of all came out of that club and the label, you know.
Thank you.
What was your first concert with the Jesus and Mary Chain?
They came down and played the club. And I couldn't even remember who they, I thought it was Mekons, but Jim says it was Micro, doesn't he? I think he's right. They were just mental. They were like, they did this sound check. And, you know, Douglas Hart looked like James Dean meets Adamant or something like that. So he looked amazing. And then Jim and William had just clothes held together by safety pins. And then they all had some sort of punch up, which I'm going, this is getting quite interesting. And then they played Vegetable Man, Syd Barrett, and Somebody to Love, Jefferson Airplane. And I thought it was amazing. So I immediately said, you want to sign to my record label? Which they, of course, said yes. Not even, I don't think they even knew I had a record label. But they, nobody else had ever even asked them to do a gig, never mind make a record. So it was game on, really.
And they were difficult from the very start, from the first
gig.
Well,
I knew what I was taking on. It was a punch up before the gig. It was debatable whether they'd even do the gig. I think I've seen in Jim Reid talk about this in a couple of interviews, and he said that the Jesus and Mary Chain prepared me for Oasis. To be honest, I'd actually agree with that, because for some reason I've always had real success with Brothers, even like the Hives, later on down the line. That was Nicholas and Pelle were Brothers, and it's like, it's always been Brothers that I've had a lot of success with, or two men in a band, or some, do you know what I mean? That kind of relationship, that's almost, if you're not brothers, it's, you're sort of like, you know, do you know what I mean? You know, that's that kind of really, really intense male thing that men have with each other, and it kind of, I seem to really work well with that energy, you know.
Your paths crossed with Innes and Bobby Gillespie again, because you...
Well, Bobby never... I mean, I never really...
Some proper screen.
I mean... Well, the Mary Chain needed a drummer. I got Bobby the gig I suggested him. He got himself the gig. But, I mean, they had a drummer. It wasn't working out. I had seen Bobby play drums with Altered Images. We got him the gig in the Mary Chain, and then Primal Scream were making the first album. It wasn't going well. They were making it with Stephen Street, the Smiths producer. It wasn't going well, and they ended up making it with Mayor Thompson. But in the midst of all that, they had a little guy, I can't remember what his name was, but he left the band. I think his name was Stuart, and I suggested Innes, and he joined Primal Scream. So then that was a big thing, you know. So but Throb was playing guitar, Throb's playing bass, and Jim was playing guitar.
And All Fall Down was the first singer that came out.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think it was kind of like one of these big C86 records, I think, that all these kids that are into that stuff love, you know. I mean, I don't really think they made a really, really great record until I'm losing more than I'll ever have, really. But yeah, a lot of people really loved Velocity Girl and stuff as well, you know.
That was Primal Scream with their first single on Creation Records, Velocity Girl, from 1985.
Six Music. BBC Six Music.
asked Alan about Creation Records' first big success in 1987.
From 84 to about 88, I thought I was kind of like on a kind of club 18 to 13 holiday, that that I didn't have to a real job, and I kind of thought, oh, I'm getting away with this. And then the Valentines kind of broke, and the House of Love really broke, and I had two kind of pretty big bands, one really big band and one pretty big band, and that was with Isn't Anything in the first House of Love album. And I kind of had to come to my senses a little bit and go, God, maybe I've got to take this a bit seriously. And then about 2 years later, by about 90, we'd got Ride, they started to break, Loaded happened, it was a hit. I was managing the House of Love, the Valentines were making Loveless. It was like, it was just a time of like, it was game on really, you know. I'd say Loaded's the key record. You know, if you're going to sum up Creation in one record, as in the key moment that it changed for the label, it was probably Loaded, really, to be honest.
Can you remember hearing it and thinking, this band have tapped into something pretty exciting here?
Well, I don't think I understood it. I think Bobby, I'll give Bobby Gillespie's absolute due. I obviously understood the Acid House connotation and, you know, what Weatherall had did, and, you know, and I understood the culture, because it was me that got Gillespie into Acid House. But I think Gillespie understood the process of and the magical quality of the cut-up thing that Burrs had kind of like conceptualised. And there is a magical element of cutting stuff up and putting it together, and we did that.
Just what is it that you want to do?
Well, we want to be free. We want to be free to do what we want to do. And we want to get loaded. And we want to have a good time. And that's what we're going to do.
Well, wait, baby, let's go.
We're going to have a good time. We're going to have a party.
We'll be right back.
When did Teenage Fan Club first walk through your door?
Well, I used to meet them in Euston Station, the Teenage Fan Club. And they used to be really nice.
They're a nice band.
And I used to be friends with them. And then I had no idea that they'd ever wanted to sign to me. And then Bob one day, I say this in the film and stuff a lot, but it's like we could never have done Creation without Bobby, because he told me about the Mary Chain, he brought me Primal Scream, and he brought me the Fan Club. He brought me, like, you know, three of the six most definitive Creation bands. And Norman and Raymond and Jerry and Brendan, that lineup was just genius, you know.
What's your favourite Teenage Fan Club track of that era? Because Bandwagon-esque was obviously one of the big breakthrough records for you.
I never put it out, unfortunately, but my favourite Teenage Fan Club record is Everything Flows. It was genius.
You also got, if we're going chronologically, your first top 10 hit single with "Leave Them All Behind" by Ride.
So that was
your, that was your first top 10 single.
Right, okay. I can never really remember these things.
Because that's another band that got huge.
Oh,
got
no, really they were big, amazing. Ride are amazing.
And kind of aren't maybe seen
with
the deference that maybe they maybe deserve.
Well, I think, funnily enough, if they reform, they're really not reformed because Andy's doing stuff with Liam, but amazing songs. Mark Gardner, real underrated talent. Andy Bell, an amazing guitar player. I mean, and they looked amazing. I mean, Mark Gardner looked as if he was like, you know, he just looked like rock royalty, like Stones in 67 or something. Do you know what I mean? He was amazing. We were lucky to get them, really, to be honest, you know.
What went wrong?
What went wrong?
Yeah.
I don't know. Well, I mean, it's like, is that not kind of like asking the question of like when George Best is lying in bed with, like, you know, Miss World, and he's got 30 grand on the bed, and the guy comes through the door and goes, "Where did it all go wrong?" I mean, what bit do you call wrong? I mean, they sold loads of records and made a lot of money.
I just mean in terms of the fact that maybe, you know, they don't get recognised. They could.
I think it was personal. I think Andy and Mark just, they were going in different directions, really, and, you know, there was two very talented guys with big egos, and they just went different ways, you know.
It's time to talk about Oasis, part of the creation story, undeniably. What was your first impression of Liam?
My first impression of Liam was he can't possibly be the singer. Like, the bald guy in the corner, Bonehead's bound to be the singer. And, you know, because that kid's just too good looking and too perfect to be the singer. So he's got to be the drug dealer. Because you know how the drug dealers were always really good looking, and if they could actually sing, they'd have been rock stars. Well, this was actually like somebody that looked like a drug dealer that was a singer.
Can you remember hearing Supersonic for the first time?
Yeah.
In the studio, recorded
version.
Yeah,
it was. I think they were doing a BBC session, and they'd brought it back from, well, I think it was recorded in Liverpool, and they played it, and it was perfect. It was amazing. But we never even at that point thought that was the first single. We always thought Bring It On Down was going to be the first single. Now, because I had this idea that it was like going to, Oasis were the revolution. Well, I got that bit right, actually. They were the revolution, but it was because of the lyrical content to Bring It On Down. Well, I was talking about bringing it all down, bringing down the music business. But we couldn't get it right, so we kept sending them back to do it again, sort of vibe. And in the middle of what was it, about 1 o'clock in the morning, and we were all just getting smashed. Me, Tim Abbott, Noel, can't remember who else was there. And Noel went, "Mickey, let's just do Supersonic." And I was like, in a manc accent, of course. and I don't know, maybe it was a good line, but I just decided, yeah, okay. And from then on, it just, the Oasis train took off, you know.
In terms of creation, it seemed like a really, really, from the outside, a really creative, exciting place to be. You know, there was the Boo Radleys coming out of it. You had St. Etienne. You had this whole list of very, very diverse bands. Did it feel like the world was your oyster at that point?
I think when I get told that I'd £8 million to spend in 1996 or 1997 on, like, on bands, I think I probably did.
That's a staggering situation, isn't it, really?
Well, yeah, but I used to get told about 1993 and 1994 I had £60,000 to sign a band, one band this year. And then in 97 I had, like, £8 million and I had to send it to the tax man, basically. So it was like, so I did my very best to I think I gave the Teenage Fan Club the deal of the century. I think I gave them I renewed their contract and gave them a load of money and gave them a 3-album firm deal, you know.
You say your interests now are more in the cinematic and literary world. Would you ever be drawn again to do another label or manage another band? Or
If it was something that, I don't think it would be management. I mean, if it was something that really, really rock and roll, as in, like, when I say, like, something so punk rock, you know, yeah, of course I would be drawn back into music, but it would have to be a genius punk rock move. Other than that, I don't really need to do it anymore, because I can live here now, and after selling 60 million records, I don't really need to do that much.
We've had all these firsts, and now we come to the last record, which is a record that you can choose.
Well, can you play the... It's a really rough recording, but is it by this young kid that lives down here? He's wrote a song, Walk by Love.
Thank you very much. It's good to speak to you.
Hey, thanks. Cheers. Lovely.
Maybe I didn't understand why I couldn't get through to you. I never left so much to chance, and needing some direction or truth. And the crazy things it made me do. If you walk by me now, you walk by love, and walk by love. Sure as life will unfold, don't walk by love to stand there alone. The world can just keep holding its breath. Don't walk by love. Stand in the sidelines this long, but coming like these fixtures you see. Everyone shuffling along. You told you're wrong, but you still believe. You save it all for someday soon. Save it up for something new. If you walk by me now, you walk by love, walk by love. Sure as life will unfold, don't walk by love to stand there alone. World can just keep holding its breath. Don't walk by love. Mm-hmm. the light in your eyes. The vital kind that no one should steal. And I could have given you more time. I said a little less than you need.
This is BBC Radio 6 Music.
Yeah, love.
Get tough.